This Week in Radio Tech is supported by Bill Meeks at Meeks Mixed Media, maximizing brands large and small in the new media space on the web at meeksmixedmedia.com, and by Violet Microphones, handcrafted in Latvia for generations, on the web at violetusa.com.
And now, our feature presentation.
Twirt.
The problem is that we're dealing with fractions of a wavelength, that the antennas are electrically short.
All right, calm down. He says that to everyone.
This calls for immediate discussion.
What can
I have all your data belong to us.
From his palatial office of important business.
Or in a choice hotel in a distant land.
This is Kirk Harnack.
On this show about antennas, we're joined by Chuck Kelly, along with our usual co-hosts Tom Ray and Chris Tarr.
You're dialed in to This Week in Radio Tech.
Hi, it's time for This Week in Radio Tech. I'm Kirk Harnack, and thank you for joining us. We've got a great show planned for you today. On the show today, we have they're all ham radio operators, amateur radio operators, plus broadcast engineers. That's a pretty potent combination. So let's run around and introduce all our guests tonight. Let's start this time out in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, with ham radio engineer extraordinaire, Chris Tarr. Hi, Chris.
Hello there, Kirk. Chris Tarr, W9JOL here.
W9JOL. Good, I got it right. I looked you up before the show started on QRZ, and there you were.
Yep, you got it right.
All right, good. Well, Chris, you'll be part of the show tonight. Also with us from the Hudson Valley, New York, it's Tom Ray. Hi, Tom.
Hey, greetings, Kirk. W2TRR over here. How you doing tonight?
I'm good. I'm very good. And also with us, our guest this evening is Chuck Kelly. Chuck works for Nautel, and he has a call sign too, a ham call sign. Chuck, tell us what that is. And hi, welcome in.
Good evening, all. My name is Chuck, and I'm in Halifax, Nova Scotia. My call is W9MDO/VE1.
All right. What's the stroke VE1? What's that all about, Chuck?
Means I'm a U.S. ham living in Canada, Nova Scotia.
Oh, okay. All right. So you're a U.S. ham call sign, but you're living in Canada. Now, the show tonight, folks, is not all about ham radio, although that'll be part of it, because we're going to talk about antennas. Oh, by the way, I'm Kirk, and my call sign is KD5FYD, Kilo Delta 5, Foxtrot Yankee Delta. So, but most of the discussion this evening is going to occur between the guys who understand antennas. A lot of the principles that we use in broadcast to understand and tune and work with antennas, whether it's AM antennas or FM antennas, those same principles apply to the hobby, the art, the science involved in being an amateur radio operator. It doesn't matter whether you're just an amateur radio operator like me who occasionally gets on an FM, a two-way radio, 2 meters or a 70-centimeter band, or if you do HF radio, high frequency, that would be a shortwave radio, where you're using antennas that are physically large and a very small portion of a wavelength in the HF band. So those are some things we're going to be talking about tonight, and we're going to relate how those principles also work in the broadcast band. So if you have an AM transmitter and you're making it work with a tower or a bunch of towers in the case of an AM directional station, that's the kind of thing that we're going to be talking about. Hey, guys, I really don't have a format really to start here. So I'll tell you what, I'm going to put the onus on our expert guest here, Chuck Kelly. Chuck, I wonder if you might kind of just give us an introduction as to thinking about antennas. And let's think about antennas for the broadcast band, for AM, and for some shortwave bands. Let's think about that size of antenna. Tell us a little bit about what an antenna is doing for our signal and what purpose the antenna has. I mean, I know it's the obvious one. It has something to do with getting the signal out there or receiving a signal if you're a ham radio operator receiving. But tell us a little bit about what the antenna is actually doing as part of a circuit.
Okay. Well, the first thing is to highlight what you just talked about. You can't hear them, or you can't work them if you can't hear them. So receiving is equally as difficult as transmitting, and that's probably the most important thing that I can relate on, especially these days with the noise floor levels, what they are. The most important thing that I was trying to figure out in my own mind exactly the direction we might take, I think the most important thing to talk about is radiation resistance. Radiation resistance is the actual part of the power that is dissipated by that you're coming out of your transmitter with that is dissipated into the antenna and directly into free space, and everything else is losses. So the power that goes into the antenna and how it's radiated, that's all it's all about. We want to maximize the radiation resistance because that minimizes the losses that the antenna has. And this is kind of an interesting thing. You talked about the fact that in HF and in the AM band, the problem is that we're dealing with fractions of a wavelength, that the antennas are electrically short for the frequencies they're used. And let's put that into perspective. Just to make it easy to think about, a half-wave antenna is probably the most typical that it's utilized, and there's another special form of a half-wave antenna we'll talk about in a second, but a half-wave antenna means that the length of the antenna is half a wavelength at the frequency of operation, and a half-wave antenna resonates at 150 over the frequency in megahertz. Real simple, that's 150 meters over the frequency in megahertz. So in other words, if you're on 1 megahertz, a half-wave antenna is 150 meters, and as you go up in frequency, that antenna gets shorter. Now, if you're not in Canada and you deal with the more conventional numbering system, that's 492 feet is a half wavelength. Now, a broadcast antenna on the AM band is very often a quarter wavelength, and so that's half a wavelength times two, because the other half of the quarter wave antenna is a mirror antenna beneath the ground. And so that's the most important things I think we can think about, is just put things in a mathematical relationship between the frequency we're operating on and the antenna length. And if you're not sitting somewhere around half a wavelength on your antenna, and remember that of the base antenna, most of that are in Houston ham radio and also in AM broadcasting, most of them revolve around the half-wave antenna. The typical antennas that are used in ham radio are the Yagi, the quad, the dipole, and the vertical. And all of those are based in one form or another on the half-wave antenna. And why is that important? Because the radiation resistance of a half-wave antenna at in free space is about 73 ohms, and that's a high number. So that means that more of the power of your transmitter is going into the radiation resistance than is being absorbed in losses. So those are the basics. Does it help put this thing on the right footing?
Yeah, it sure does, Chuck. I appreciate that very much. So let's chat with Tom and Chris for a moment. Tom, last week, after our show last week, you and I were chatting about doing a show about antennas, and you mentioned that Amateur Radio Field Day is coming up, and you also told me a little bit about a particularly interesting antenna that you and some other ham operators make, whip up, modify, use. What can you tell us about something about a flagpole?
Ah, yes. Well, we do Field Day here in the Newburgh, New York area, up at Cronimer Hill Park in Newburgh. It's the highest point around here, and it's a great place to set up a beam antenna. But a couple of years ago, we were checking out the site, and we sat there and took a look at it, and I said, you know, that flagpole looks like it's pretty close to a 40-meter antenna. And somebody in the club said, you know, we've been thinking about trying that for years, but it'll never work. It's grounded. I said, yeah, watch me. So what we did was we fed it with a shunt wire. I actually sat down. I modeled it on EasyNeck.
Yeah. And what's EasyNeck? That's some kind of computer program?
Yeah, EasyNeck is a computer program. There is a free version, which is kind of limited, but there is several versions you can pay for, and you model antennas on it. You can model the current distribution on the antenna. It gives you the actual feed point resistance. I think it gives you the radiation resistance. You can do VisWire runs, and you can modify the antenna. It shows you gain and everything else. So it's kind of a neat program. And I had to use some real world practicality. So the first things first, I said, you know, how high up can we do something with to feed this flagpole? Well, realistically, yeah, we'd have an 8-foot ladder, so therefore you can't feed it much more than 9 feet up. So I said, okay, well, just for fun, let's feed it with a slant wire, which is not allowed in AM broadcast anymore. Let's feed it 9 feet up and I started doing some runs, and it came out that the feed point resistance 9 feet up that tower was something in the neighborhood of 83 ohms plus, minus J189. So it was more than easy to tune.
I was just going to think that from those numbers, I thought that'd be difficult to tune, but you say that's easy to tune.
Well, it's very easy to tune because you're looking for 50 ohms for the transmission line. And thinking back to, you know, for example, like the WOR towers, a non-directional WOR tower is about 200 ohms at the base. Yeah. And that's, you know, relatively easy to tune. But, I mean, 83 ohms is not that far off from 50 ohms.
It's close to 50. What about the J? And, by the way, the J, that's the capacitance or reactance of the tower.
Right. In this case, it was capacitance. And we built a plus 90-degree network because the plus 90-degree networks tend to give you a little better bandwidth. So we built a T network of oversized components that I borrowed from WOR. Nothing like pumping between 5 and 100 watts into a tower that's actually built for about 30,000 watts. we tuned it, and I had a pretty 50 J0 right at the transmitter. As a matter of fact, it was pretty close to 50 J0 across the whole 40-meter band.
Hi, this is Chuck Kelly. Sorry I missed your call. Please do leave me a message, and I'll get back with you as quickly.
And we, one of our guys likes to run QRP or low power, 5 watts. So he hooked his transmitter into it, and everybody was skeptical. They were standing around going, yeah, this isn't going to work. This isn't going to work. His first contact was Hawaii with 5 watts.
On the oh, my God. With 5 watts like into a flagpole.
And we're talking 3 in the afternoon. We're not talking 2 in the morning.
Yeah. Wow. So, hey, I got a hint on the video that the Twit Network may have this video ready for us to watch. Here we go. This is the demolition of a Loran tower, and there's some audio with it, but it's just background audio, Twit guys, if you want to leave that up a little bit, that'd be just
fine.
Wasn't
this tower something like 1,500 feet, Kirk?
I thought pretty big. 11, 12, 1,300 feet, something pretty tall. We can look it back up and put it in the show notes, but they're going to do some demolition on one of the guy anchor points. And when they do, of course, the other guy wires pull that down.
And having done this at WOR a couple of years ago, it's cool to see when you stand there.
I'm amazed at how fast, however much that is. It's over 1,000 feet of power. How fast, like, here's the guy anchor point. There's the demolition.
Wow. We just cut ours.
there's one more angle that I'd like to show. The whole video is several minutes long, and it shows the demolition of this tower from 6 different angles, including a couple where the tower comes fabulously close to the camera. Here's the tower base. And now watch as the tower base slides off. Okay, that's enough of the video. If you want to see the rest of it, you can check it out online. We'll put the URL in the show notes. It's on YouTube. You could probably just get on YouTube and search for Loran Tower demolition. That occurred in Alaska earlier this year. That's kind of cool. So, Tom, that tower was really, really tall. And I see Chuck's back with us now. Chuck, you've been around a Loran installation or two, or what can you tell us about why is that tower so tall?
I think we may still be having internet connection difficulties. Are you hearing me all right?
Well, it's a little blocky. The audio's listenable.
Okay. Loran towers, the thing that's most important about them is they're very low frequency. And I was just doing some quick calculations, however, and a 1,500-foot tower makes a pretty good dent. It's close to 90 degrees or a quarter wavelength, which would be more or less ideal. So that's a very effective radiator at those frequencies.
Yep. So the idea here is that we're trying to get this tower to be a significant portion of a wavelength at the frequency involved. Loran, is that 100 kilohertz? Is that what the...
It's in that neighborhood, 125, 140 kilohertz, something like that.
Yeah, so it's very, very well below the AM broadcast band. You know, your AM radio can't tune that low. That's why such a long radiator is required to be efficient, to efficiently get that transmitted signal out and into the atmosphere. A lot of other antennas, though, are much shorter. And Chris Tarr, you're online with us. Chris, you've got some AM towers that you take care of there. I believe you've got a directional array. What's the frequency of your AM there?
The frequency is 1250.
So that's a little bit above the middle of the AM band. How tall are the towers there, and you know what? How many degrees they are?
Well, I don't know the degrees offhand. The towers are just a little over 400 feet, and the reason they did that originally, they were very short towers. But we do have on one of the towers our FM station, which is a 50 kilowatt class B. And so we have the tower, the antennas mounted on top. And I'm sorry, it's almost 500 feet, the height of those towers. So I believe it's close to 5/8 wave system. At least four of the five towers are. And they're very closely spaced together. It's kind of interesting the way they designed the array. It was originally a seven-tower array and with much shorter towers. And they figured out a way to cut back by two towers. They're making them a little bit higher, but redesigned the array to get the same day and night pattern with only five towers instead of seven. And that was probably about 50 years ago that they made that change. But you can still see out in the field the old tower bases from where the old towers were sitting.
Wow. If you can provide us with a URL or a link to a picture of that array, that would be kind of cool. Five towers, they're 400 feet each. That seems a little unusual. Those seem like about a half wave tall or at least pretty close to that. You know if that's
better? They're actually a little bit taller. They're closer to 500 feet than 400 feet.
Wow.
A 5/8 wave would be what those work out to. And that's a very, very nice number for AM broadcasting because it puts more power right at the horizon and gives it higher gain at the horizon, which is what you want for ground wave.
Chuck, yeah, give us a little bit of that.
As a matter of fact, we had an issue with that with one of the towers at night in our night pattern is completely off for the night pattern. But the problem was because of that nice low angle, that tower had a real bad re-radiation problem, even grounded out. And so we ended up having to put a detuning skirt on the top half of the tower that is engaged only in the night pattern, which electrically breaks up that tower so we don't have those issues.
It's a very efficient radiator. It's a lovely thing.
You mentioned that 5/8 is good for an AM radiator, and this is an interesting subject, I think. You know, a lot of AM radio stations, a lot of people try to get a tower that's a quarter of a wavelength tall, and you talked about that earlier as to why that works out at least fairly well for AM broadcasters and for shortwave broadcasters, for ham radio operators who are working off a vertical radiator, because the other half is sort of mirrored under the ground, if you will. It behaves almost as if it were a half wave. But the radiation pattern from a quarter wave radiator, that is where the signal goes around the earth. Are we putting signal over people, over radios that can hear it? It may not be quite ideal with a quarter wave radiator because a lot of the signal kind of goes up into the sky at an angle and never reaches a person that way. I guess what we'd probably want to do is get as much signal as we can to go on the ground or along the ground and not have a high angle of radiation. So, Chuck, what does height figure into this equation about angle of radiation?
Well, that's one of the things that somebody mentioned EasyNet before, and it's a wonderful program. And I've put the link to that program software, sent it to you so you can add it to the website there, Kirk. But the EasyNet will allow you to model an antenna in the horizontal as well as the vertical pattern. And it's very, very effective in doing that. And the advantage of that is you can actually see what your antenna is doing. It's GIGO, just like any computer program. But as long as it's accurate information you're putting in, it'll give you a pretty good idea of what's happening with signal. And let's not discount the benefit of SkyWave. Sending signal up into the air isn't such a bad thing, particularly in the nighttime hours, because that's how you get heard at a long distance away.
Aha. Uh-huh. Yep. Yeah. Chuck, you've also worked with some shortwave broadcasters and AM broadcasters around the world. So how important is SkyWave to them? I mean, here in the U.S., I tend to think of SkyWave as being primarily for listening to a ball game in the city you used to live in, you know, from the big AM station there, or if you're a trucker traveling distances overnight, a SkyWave might be important to you. Yeah, there are hobbyists who listen to AM stations coming in from a distance at night, but probably not as many as there used to be. So how is SkyWave important for services maybe other than the AM broadcast band?
Well, in the shortwave band, you tune the direction of your signal both in the azimuth of the station, that is the direction to the station horizontally, but also in the vertical angle in the sky wave. And if you've got not too far from where I live here, about an hour away, is the location of Radio Canada International's transmitting site in Sackville, New Brunswick. And I actually had an opportunity to go visit that site a few weeks ago, and it's fantastic. You sit there at all the 500 kilowatt transmitters here, I think there's 7 or 8 of them, and they change frequency into all these curtain antennas and things strung along the side of the Trans-Canadian Highway. And what they do is very accurately computer model exactly what the target area is and calculate out both the azimuth and the estimated vertical angle of incidence or the skywave angle that they need to maximize their power. And these antennas are tuned for that. And the actual angle that you get in a shortwave antenna is not only a product of the length of the antenna. In this case, it's less of that. It's actually, because these are horizontal antennas, they're curtain antennas, it's actually the angle of the height of the antenna above ground. They're using, in essence, dipoles and complex installations of dipoles, and it's the height of the antenna above ground that creates the takeoff angle and thus determines how far the signal is going to go.
Hey, I want to talk for a couple minutes about different ways to feed an antenna. And let's consider for a few moments the standard AM vertical radiator. So your vertical tower, like the tower that we saw demolished in Alaska, that tall Loran tower, most AM broadcast stations have towers that are probably as low as 150 feet tall, up to 500 or 600 or 700 feet tall. In fact, just yesterday, I stopped by the WSM transmitter site just south of Nashville in Brentwood, Tennessee. Because of the flooding in Nashville, the WSM studios at the Opryland Hotel are underwater and probably smelling pretty bad right now. So they've put temporary studios at the transmitter site. So they're actually, you know, making their programming from the transmitter site, doing a heck of a good job. In fact, there's maybe some pictures online we'll try to point you to with that. But so WSM has a pretty tall antenna. It's a 5/8 wave antenna. But what I was curious about discussing is different ways that we energize the antenna, different ways that we provide a feed to that antenna. Pretty much the standard way that AM broadcasters feed an antenna is what we call a series feed, a series-fed AM antenna. And I'll describe this, and then I'm going to ask Chris and Tom to describe some other feed methods that they may be familiar with. A series-fed antenna is a tower, a steel tower, that is sitting on an insulator. Usually it's a big piece of ceramic that's made just to be an insulator. And the full weight of the tower, the full weight of all that steel, is sitting on a piece of ceramic that's shaped so that it's being compressed. Ceramic is very, very strong in compression. And then the signal from the transmitter is fed usually through a tuning unit. This helps match the impedance of the tower to the characteristic impedance of the transmitter and the transmission line. That's usually 50 ohms and plus or minus J0, so there's no reactance there or very little. And the feed just connects directly to the steel of the tower itself, usually at the bottom of the tower. So the tower is what we call hot. If you were to walk up to an AM tower that's on and touch it, you would either die or get a heck of a burn and a shock. If it's a very, very low power, you could draw an arc or feel more than a tingle. Those of us who are engineers who've been, you know, accidentally run into a tower without looking that's energized, you know what I'm talking about. So it's fed at the bottom. And the entire tower itself is usually the radiator, unless there's some breakup insulators somewhere in the tower. That would be pretty unusual. And so this is series fed. Then in the ground surrounding the tower are copper wires that emanate as spokes do on a bicycle wheel. There's usually a ring of copper strap in the ground or just above the ground all around the tower. And then there's usually 120 copper wires that go out in all directions. Every 3 degrees would be 120, 360 degrees around. And these wires are usually buried anywhere from 6 inches down to sometimes a foot and a half down. And these make the ground plane that the antenna works against. It actually makes a bit of a capacitance between the vertical tower and the ground plane that is under the ground. So this combination, when if you make this tower a quarter wave tall at the frequency of interest, at the frequency you're transmitting or receiving, the tower will have a characteristic impedance usually in the mid-30s to 40 ohms or so. I think 36 or 38 ohms come to mind as the theoretical impedance of a tower that's a quarter wave tall under all things being ideal. And
hey, Kirk? Could you briefly go over for everybody what the ground system does for an AMRA?
Well, you know, I was going to let somebody else do that. The ground system does my understanding, a couple of things, and I could be wrong here as to its primary purpose. I always thought that the ground system's primary purpose, well, two equally important purposes. One was to make sure that the transmission system, the ground side of it, is firmly tied into Mother Earth. And you don't need a ground radial field to do that. You can do that with some ground rods. The ground radial field increases the efficiency of the transmission in all directions that there's ground radials. And it does that because it actually makes, as I sort of make with my hands here, it makes a capacitance. You can draw a capacitor in the air between the tower, vertical structure, and the ground radials themselves. That's part of the tuning of the system. That capacitance enters into the entire equation of how this radiator behaves electrically. By the way, the radials are typically a quarter wave long themselves. Even if the tower is higher than a quarter wave or less than a quarter wave, they generally try to make the ground radials a quarter wave long. If you don't use enough ground radials, you will have decreased efficiency in radiation from that tower. And in the U.S. anyway, the FCC has some requirements about how efficient a radiator needs to be. So that's my explanation. Chris, if you have a better one, or Tom or Chuck, if you do, please jump right in and tell us about what a radial ground system does.
No, actually, that's pretty good. A perfect ground system would be solid copper going out to the horizon. Obviously, we can't do that, which is why we use the radial spacings that we do. And, another issue, if you have a tower like that that doesn't have a ground system, is you'll see not only decreased efficiency in the ground wave, but you'll see increased efficiency sky wave generally. All that radiation shooting up into space, and your ground wave all of a sudden gets much better, your sky wave, rather, gets much better, while your ground wave signal gets much worse.
You know, something else I've noticed is that if the ground system is in poor condition, if it doesn't have 120 radials, if they're in bad shape, if they're corroded, then the weather conditions, the dryness or the wetness of the soil, will have a larger effect on changes in the antenna's characteristic impedance than if you have a proper ground system. A good proper ground system that's in will minimize the day-to-day, week-to-week, month-to-month, seasonal changes that occur in the wetness or dryness of the ground. Go ahead.
I was just going to add one thing to that. I've actually had an experience much like what you're talking about. I was in Asia. I was going to visit an AM station that had one of our transmitters, and they were having very, very poor coverage. They hear the station even a few miles away, and the transmitter was working fine. It was 5 or 10 kilowatts of whatever it was supposed to put into the antenna. And I looked out, and as is typical in this part of Southern Asia, there was it was a rice field. The antenna was in the rice field, and I asked him. I said, "Well, how does the farmer plow this field?" He said, "Well, it comes in here with the oxen." And I said, "Did they ever find any wires when he was plowing the rice field?" Well, yeah. Turns out he plowed up his entire rice field, and there was no radial field at all. And you're right. The effect was the transmitter was working just fine. What was happening is, and it's very interesting, from the standpoint of looking at the meters in the transmitter, you couldn't tell anything was wrong. But what was happening is the amount of power that was going into ground losses was greater than the amount of power that was going into the antenna. And your comment about all these radials being a quarter wave is very important because one end of the radial is left dangling, and the other end
the quarter wave point is turned, is connected, brazed typically to the ground center of the antenna, to the counterpoise of the antenna. And the key point is that one of the characteristics of a quarter wave is that the impedance at one end is the complete opposite of the impedance of the other. So if we have an open at one end, then we have a virtual short at the other. And so with all those radials connected to the center, the whole concept is to lower the ground losses as much as possible to maximize the amount of power that's dissipated through radiation resistance.
Radiation resistance. You mentioned that earlier. And yeah, so I was going to actually follow up on what you said about that. You said that we want to maximize radiation resistance. And I don't think that means we want to make the resistance of radiation higher necessarily. We just want to make sure that the radiation resistance is the majority by a long shot of any resistances that are in the system. We don't want any other losses besides the radiation resistance, which, good thing, isn't really a loss. That's what we're putting out. Did I get that kind of right?
I think that's right. One way of looking at it is like a light bulb. When we power a light bulb, the idea is to put the amount of power into the light bulb and maximize the amount of light out. But what the waste in a light bulb is heat. And just the same happens in an antenna system. If you have a hot antenna system, that means your hard-earned power is going up in heat instead of into broadcasting, into reaching the receiver. And so you've got high ground losses or other electrical losses, and that's why that's just wasted power, just like an incandescent bulb tends to be very inefficient.
So we're going to soldier on into some other feed methods, but we'll finish up on the series feed. And so, again, this is where we're feeding the bottom of the tower. The tower is insulated from the ground, and we have a ground radial system. There's plenty of things we could learn about things like the current distribution and the voltage distribution in the tower itself. If the bottom of the tower is typically going to be the lowest resistance on the tower, and so the current is the highest there and the voltage is the lowest at that point. And as we go up the tower, up to the quarter wave point anyway, if the tower is taller than a quarter wave, the voltage will increase and the current will decrease. Obviously there's no current at the top of the tower, it's not hooked to anything. So the voltage there is going to be maximized at the top of the tower. So this is the voltage and current distribution that are across there. So if we could, let's I described this series feed, which is very, very typical for AM stations. But Tom, you mentioned about your field day and a slant wire feed with a flagpole. Now, Tom, the flagpole, the bottom of it's grounded. How does this work?
Correct. Well, what you're doing is you're feeding the tower, in this case, the flagpole, about 9 feet up. You're finding a point that makes it convenient to match. In the case of AM broadcast, the FCC doesn't allow that anymore, but there still are some older towers that do that with a slant wire. And what they did was they actually moved this wire up and down the tower, and they found usually a 50-ohm point and canceled the reactants at the bottom. So it was a very simple tuning network and a very broadband tuning network. You still have the ground system. You still have the tuning network. It's just that the feed point is different and the tower is grounded. So you could actually walk up to this tower and touch it, and it's not a problem. But the reason the FCC doesn't allow it anymore is that that slant wire, that feed, can radiate, and that causes some skywave issues. So they you can do it with ham. You can't do it with broadcast anymore. But that's how it works. You're actually breaking up the current distribution on the tower. And you're feeding it. You're just feeding the tower at a different point, so you can ground the bottom of it, and the current starts picking up from there.
Thomas, is there much difference or any difference between a shunt wire feed and a slant wire feed? Obviously, a slant wire feed is slanted. I've seen them go back to the roof of the radio station where the transmitter is just below in the room, just below that point on the roof. It really was a slant wire feed, or from a tuning box that's maybe 50 feet away from the tower, and then a slanted wire goes up to the tower. But I've also seen, I think, what you'd call a shunt wire, where the hot wire from the tuning box goes up the side of the tower off insulators to a point that I assume is like a 50-ohm point on the tower for convenience and tuning, and connects there. Any real differences in these feeds?
Oh, well, there probably would be. I mean, if you're going to insulate the feed going up, you're going to be feeding the tower usually at some point, let's call it a quarter wave point. And I had a tower like this. It was in Hartford. It was at WTIC. We used the television tower as a backup radiator, but we didn't feed it at the quarter wave point. We had transmission, they had other antennas on this TV tower. So yeah. We had the transmission lines were actually insulated from this tower up to the quarter wave point. Then they bonded and became part of the tower for the rest of the way up. And basically it became a quarter wave stub. And the transmission lines, from the quarter wave point down, it was kind of irrelevant as long as you had them insulated properly. And there was one guy who didn't one day, and we had to use the tower. And let me tell you, his line burned off in a hurry.
So I've got a surprise question for Chris Tari. I wasn't expecting this. Chris, do you know much about another type of feed, which is typically called a folded unipole? You got any experience with these?
I actually have some experience, yes. Most of them not good, unfortunately.
Oh, no. See, I've had some pretty good experience with these. This is a folded unipole is sort of like a piece of inside-out transmission line, right, where the tower is grounded, and then there's wires that go up the side of the tower. They're, set off from the tower by insulators, and we feed those wires. So it's sort of like a series-fed tower, but the tower, the structure itself, isn't hot with RF, at least not at the ground level. Has that been your experience?
That's exactly what it is. And a lot of times, actually, that's a solution for example, towers that have insulators that don't work very well anymore, have poor grounding. A lot of times that's a fix. One of the issues that I've had with them, especially when you get to this part of the country, is icing. And I remember getting a call for a station at AM that I worked for that from the operator who was saying he couldn't get the transmitter to stay on, or at least at a very, very low power. And so I drove up, and the first thing I noticed, there's ice everywhere. There's a big ice storm that came through. And I turn on the power of the transmitter, immediately it would, just shut off. And there was some sort of, reflected power issue. I look out the tower, and it iced so much that it covered both the antenna, the tower, the structure, and the antenna, which effectively shorted out that wire unipole antenna to the structure with all the ice and wouldn't radiate. So the only thing you could do is kind of wait for the sun to come out and the ice to melt, and everything was fine again. And they do require a little bit more maintenance because, those insulators are very critical to the operation of that antenna. And of course, too, there's usually some sort of, fine tuning down at the antenna connection point, usually some sort of small tuning network, either capacitor or something like that. Also that because it's exposed to the elements, oftentimes corrodes or through the wind or whatever gets whipped around and they break. So they work very well, and they're great in certain situations where, for example, you can't have a real tall tower, or there's efficiency issues or grounding issues or those sorts of things. But they do require a little more maintenance for the engineer because of all the parts involved and things like that.
Yeah. As a small town station owner myself, we've had a couple of AM towers that we have that started out life as a series fed tower, and we turned them into a folded unipole tower by taking a piece of copper strap and bridging across that base insulator. So now the tower's grounded, and then we would install a kit. You can buy the stuff individually, but we bought a kit to put these skirt wires, as they're called, skirt wires up the tower, and then tie them off at a point on the tower that will result in about a 50 ohm or so point at the bottom of the tower where we're actually feeding it. And there's a ring that goes around these skirt wires at the bottom so as to equally feed all three, or in some cases four or six, skirt wires. But what this let us do as small town broadcasters, this let us put more easily other things on that tower, like a microwave receiving dish or an FM transmitting antenna for a low power FM translator station. And we didn't have to go through a bunch of rigmarole to insulate those coaxes from the tower, as you would have to do if it's a series fed tower. But instead, we were able to bond those coaxes to the tower itself, because the tower itself was DC ground, and adding those coaxes didn't change the impedance or didn't mess anything up. Go ahead, Chris.
Sure. You don't have to deal with isocouplers and things like that when you do that with your AM antenna. But there's a situation here in Milwaukee where there was a freestanding AM tower. So obviously each leg had a big ceramic base insulator on it. And over time, those started to fail. And they had two options. They could either jack the tower and replace the base insulators, or encase it all and go to a folded unipole design. And that's what they did. It was just, in the long run, it was cheaper and easier to do that instead of doing a tower jacking and replace all the base insulators. They just put in a folded unipole and then encased the base insulators in concrete and just created new concrete footings. So, you know, there's several ways to, you know, that you'd utilize something like that, and all very good reasons. I like yours with the, you know, with the FM tower. That's, it can get expensive when you have a lot of things that you want to put on an AM tower and you're looking at having to do, you know, isocoupling and grounding and those sorts of things. It's a whole lot easier if you don't have to deal with any of that.
Yeah, especially if your AM tower is in a great place for a cell tower to be, then you can perhaps put a beefed up tower there, make it a grounded tower, make it a folded unipole, and then rent out space to the cell company, which is probably going to make more money than a lot of AM stations is going to. Hey, I'd like to get back with Chuck Kelly here and ask him about some unusual antennas. Chuck is the sales manager for a company called Nautel, Nautical Electronics, I think was the name's genesis, and they make transmitters for all sorts of purposes that are used in hostile conditions around the world, some of which are AM radio stations. When I was in American Samoa, I noticed that the airport there has a non-directional beacon. This is what you know, airplanes fly to when they're looking for American Samoa at 9 o'clock at night and trying to find the airport from several hundred miles out. And there's this 10,000-watt non-directional low-frequency beacon that the aircraft has direction-finding equipment and can home in on it. Well, the transmitter that I saw there was made by Nautel, and the antenna was pretty interesting. It was two wires that were stretched between very tall telephone poles and then a feed point up through the middle of it. Chuck, what can you tell me about this kind of antenna? What is it doing exactly?
Well, I don't know that specific antenna, Kirk, but I suspect what it was a vertical with a capacitive hat at the top, so that the feed point really was at the base. So it was really a vertical antenna, just like the quarter waves we've been talking about, although it was probably shortened and thus lower efficiency. But the advantage of having a capacitance hat on the top of the tower is it pulls the current up the tower, and the higher the current, the more area that the high current areas are that's where the radiation comes from. So by pulling the current up the tower, it makes the antenna more efficient. And a capacitance hat is actually a very, very effective tool when you're using a shortened antenna. And as you mentioned, the beacons are very low frequency, and so that means that a quarter wavelength or a half wavelength, for that matter, would be a very long antenna or a very tall antenna in this case, and which is very often not economical. So what ends up happening is they use these capacitance hats. And another interesting application, I don't know if you've seen these, Kirk, but you can actually make a shortened antenna a bit more efficient by connecting the guy wires at the top of the antenna and then coming down to the first insulator and insulating at that point. So in essence, you have then, as the radiator for the vertical, you have the entire length of the tower, plus you've got the capacitance of the guy wires at the top down to the first insulator. And that becomes a very effective tool. By the way, I wanted to add one more thing on the discussion of the folded unipole. I think it's a very good antenna. I think the use that you've discussed is ideal. The only problem I think I have with it, apart from the icing issue that Chris mentioned, is that sometimes some of the claims that are made for that antenna aren't really factual, and I would suggest that if you do a little Googling on the net, you'll find that there's an excellent technical paper. I believe it was by Hammett and Edison in conjunction with Kentronics about 10 years back that talked about there were issues about efficiency beyond its wavelength. There were issues about bandwidth beyond what an antenna of that type ought to have, and it's really not sustainable, I don't think, or substantiable that those claims are true. So as long as you're doing it for the kinds of reasons that you're talking about, Kirk, it makes all the sense in the world. But if you don't have those issues, don't go to it thinking you're going to get something that's not that physics doesn't make possible.
I understand that the ground system is just as important with a folded unipole as without. At least that's what people who I trust say, but there are other people who have said that, well, if your ground system is bad, if your ground radials have rotted away or corroded away, then put up a folded unipole and you don't need those ground radials anymore. Chuck, have you found that to be true?
No. You know, it's still a series-fed antenna, and it's still depending on the ground resistance being low in order to minimize the amount of power that's dissipated. So, no, that's not true. You know, I think it's just a little bit like, you know, investing on the stock market. If it sounds too good to be true, it probably is.
Chuck, there's no such thing as a free lunch, is by my theory.
That's right.
Chuck, so, actually, I kind of stopped you there when I asked you earlier about some other unusual antennas, because I described the top-loaded non-directional beacon in American Samoa, and since then I've seen others like that. What are some other unusual antennas you've seen around the world? And after you talk about one or two of those, let's talk about how you feed those with a transmitter. What are some of the challenges involved?
Well, I think that probably the most interesting antenna I ever saw, and I know we're talking about HF here, but I've got to break into VHF for a moment. For a number of years, I was chief engineer of some stations in southwestern Colorado, and we had a station on top of a 10,000-foot mountain, a translator station. And up at the top of the hill that our translator was on, a fellow had built a receive antenna, and it was just the most amazing thing I'd ever seen. It was a group of about 25 Rhone 45, I guess, 100-foot towers, 25 of them drilled into the granite top of this mountaintop in southwestern Colorado in a semicircle. And then he had stretched he built angle iron across the top 80 foot of those 100-foot towers in kind of a semicircle vertically. And then he'd stretch bicycle wire back and forth across the 500 foot from one edge of this semicircle of towers to the other. In effect, he built a 500 foot wide by 100 foot tall parabolic antenna. And in the focal point of that antenna, he had a small Radio Shack Yagi, and he was picking up stations on UHF from Albuquerque, New Mexico. And I walked into the focal point of that antenna with my IC2AT ICOM and talked to God.
Oh, my goodness. That's hard to imagine. Do you know if a picture of that exists anywhere we could put on our show notes?
I don't know.
That just sounds incredible.
Cavernous Mountain in southwestern Colorado.
All right, we'll look for that. So that's an unusual. So he was using that for receiving, so then he could translate that and retransmit it, right?
That's right. And it was just a spectacular. This guy was a complete amateur, in the best sense of the word, and like a ham operator. But what a tremendous. It took him 3 years to build the antenna, and I just think those types of things are wonderful.
So let's we've only got a few minutes left in the show, Chuck. Kind of tell us, if you would, some of the challenges you've seen in matching. That's something we haven't talked a whole lot about. We've thrown around the word the term 50 ohms and plus or minus J0 or, you know, plus or minus J something. What are some of the challenges in matching the characteristic impedance of a given structure that we're going to use as our antenna into the impedance that a transmitter would like to work into?
Well, I think the biggest thing you have to look at is not only losses. We want to minimize the losses in a matching network. We want to maximize the radiation resistance and the power dissipated there, as opposed to anything else. And that includes losses in the feed line, losses in the matching system, losses in the ground radials. But I think the other thing that's a very important issue is bandwidth. It's very easy to match an antenna at a carrier frequency, at a particular frequency. But modulation, whether it's AM or FM broadcasting, occurs on either side of the carrier frequency. And maximizing our bandwidth is very, very important, because that all the information is carried in the sidebands, in the modulation, and that's not on the carrier frequency, it's on the adjacent frequencies. And so that's a very, very important thing. And as you have a shorter antenna, the matching shorter antenna electrically, as you're less and less of a wavelength, the difficulty of matching an antenna over bandwidth is greater. And that's probably the biggest issue that people have in matching antennas.
Gotcha. All right. Chuck, if you would, in just a take a minute or two and tell us a bit about the company you work for, Nautel. What are some of their specialties? What are some of the technologies that they have developed and are putting to use in transmitters around the world?
Well, thank you, Kirk. Well, we're located in Halifax, Nova Scotia, on the shores of St. Margaret's Bay. And as you mentioned, the company is called was originally called Nautical Electronic Labs. The original concept of the company was that in order to have very, very high reliability for beacon transmitters, because it, as you mentioned, if you're coming into American Samoa and it's late at night and the transmitter is the only thing you're homing in on, it's really important to have a reliable transmitter. And so they figured out some 41 years ago that the highest reliability transmitters would be solid state. This was a time when all transmitters were tube type, and yet these guys pioneered solid state over 40 years ago. And in the entire 40 year history of this organization, which has grown from beacons to AM broadcasting to FM broadcasting, the company's never built a tube type transmitter.
Huh. I know that as a pilot, Chuck, I have honed my ADF, my automatic direction finder, in on transmitters and found out later that it was an Autel transmitter that I was tuning into to guide me to that radio station, to that airport.
Well, that's the way it works. That's the way the company was founded, was on that kind of reliability. And it just kind of followed that broadcasters wanted that kind of reliability, too.
Gotcha. Well, Chris, you had a quick question about FM, something you wanted to comment on before we close off tonight.
Yeah, it wasn't as much a question, but as Chuck was talking about, a bad month of antennas and things, it just kind of reminded me of something we do up north a lot with FM antennas, because again, those antennas are frequency, are tuned to a certain frequency. And then Chuck was talking about the sidebands, upper and lower, and needing to have that information. One of the tricks we do here up north, where we get a lot of ice, is a lot of times we put the antennas in, we tune them slightly up in frequency so that when they ice, it brings it back down into frequency so that the transmitters stay happy.
Huh. That's interesting. So the bandwidth is good enough to where if it's tuned up a little bit, it's okay. But when the ice comes in, you've got more room for more ice before things go haywire.
Right, because what will happen is the ice actually brings the resonant frequency down. And if you're up just a little bit, it gives you a lot of room to slide down before you have problems. So you'll see that a lot when they're tuning antennas up here is, they'll go just slightly above frequency when they tune them, just so that when they ice up, they don't go too far south to the point where the transmitter's unhappy.
Gotcha. Hey, everybody, we're going to have to close the show out. We appreciate your participation. You can subscribe to This Week in Radio Tech by going to the iTunes store and searching for TWIRT, T-W-I-R-T. And there's two of them there. Ours is pretty obvious, so subscribe to that. You'll automatically be able to download each new edition of This Week in Radio Tech every week. Plus, there's an RSS feed button on the website. The website is thisweekinradiotech.com. And also, that's where you'll find the show notes. So we'll have quite a few notes from this show. You can tune in. You can go there, browse there to thisweekinradiotech.com, look for this week's episode, and check out the show notes. A lot of we'll have pictures there and articles that give some substantial, some text and some graphs, give some meaning to some of the things we've talked about on the show this evening. Hey, Chuck Kelly from Halifax, I sure would like to have you back on the show again to talk about some other technical subject, maybe HD or digital differential GPS, something else like that.
I'd be delighted, my friend.
All right. Chuck, thanks very much for being with us. Chris Tarr from Milwaukee, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you.
And Tom Ray from the Hudson Valley of New York, appreciate you being here in your ham shack.
I appreciate you inviting me back, Kirk.
All right. And thanks to all the listeners. We'll see you next week on This Week in Radio Tech.
That's all the bandwidth we can pill for this week. Another TWIRT has propagated, and all the transmitters and audio equipment live happily ever after, thanks to the handsome engineer and his kind, benevolent care. We'll be back next week.
Lord willing, and the creek don't rise.
This Week in Radio Tech. Subscribe to iTunes and you'll never miss a show. Search for This Week in Radio Tech in the iTunes store. Soliciting is strictly encouraged. If you like today's show, tell a friend. If you didn't like it, we were never here. Kirk Harnack's wardrobe provided by the Salvation Army and the Red Cross Disaster Relief Services. Hair and makeup provided by Penny LaPay Garcia Hernandez Weinberg.
He's unique, wouldn't you say?
I just want to get it over with.
This ends this transmission.
Tango, Whiskey, India, Romeo, Tango.
Signing off. Okay.